This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 258 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I want to introduce two co-hosts. We'll start off first with Rob Mark, our pilot and publisher of the Jetwine blog.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just making airplane noises because I'm getting all psyched up for AirVenture next week. And I'm... You know, of course, going to be up there with a bunch of other aviation geeks. Unfortunately, none of you guys can make it.
No, but not this year.
We'll write back home and tell you how much fun you missed, or maybe we shouldn't do that.
Yeah, you'll have to bring us back some good photos and some good reports from
and some empty beer cans.
Empty beer cans. All right. The other co-host joining us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hi. Yes, folks, it's official. I am not going, but Rob will be there, so feel free to torment him on Max and I's behalf.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm thinking next year, though. I'm thinking motorhome, you know, something big with a giant Airplane Geeks banner on the side of it. That's kind of where my head is, but not this year, unfortunately.
Well, you know, they'll have a chance to torment me and a number of other aviation new media folks on Wednesday night if they go to the Airplaneista party. I think it starts at 5:30 somewhere around the media tent there, and there's going to be all kinds of fun and games and awards and people chatting like they know what they're talking about. And so Dan Pimentel says it's going to be really fun. So come on out and join us.
And you remember how you can vote, right? OshBash.
Oh, yeah.
OshBash.com/vote. So if you haven't done that yet, or if you'd like to do it again, because I guess there's no limit. Maybe the limit is one vote per day.
Yeah, I think so. And of course, Dave Allen's going to be in our best... He'll be in the clouds there somewhere because his next baby is due about that time, so he won't.
We have a big announcement.
Oh,
Dave Allen had a baby boy this morning.
Oh, no just kidding! I didn't even hear that.
Just in time to have a baby boy that there was some birth in Great Britain or something like that that was significant too. I don't know what all that was about, but congratulations to Dave Allen and his wife on their new. On their new boy.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, cool.
All right, coming up, we have a fantastic guest this episode. It's Lieutenant Colonel Brian Allen. He's with the 146th Airlift Wing of the California Air National Guard. And we're going to talk to him about, well, fire suppression via C-130. So this is going to be a terrific interview. Yeah, stick around for that.
I used to think towing banners was scary, but when I listen to what these guys do, and, you know, 150, 160,000 pound airplanes at, I don't know, 100 feet above the ground. I cringe.
Stay tuned for that. We're going to start off with some aviation news from the past week, as always. And after we interview the colonel, we're going to listen to David. David, do you have an airplane of the week?
The XF-84H Thunder Screech. The reason why I chose it was it flew on the day we're recording, July 22nd, and it first flew in July 22nd, 1955.
Wow, cool. All right, that's an odd kind of an aircraft, so we'll look forward to listening to you talk about that. And then we also have Steve and Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast with their Australia desk report. And as you'll hear when we play that, another PCDU team member has taken a flight in a C-130, so they're kind of continuing that theme. And then Peter Johnson brings us an Across the Pond segment, again with GA pilot Neil Braden. We'll find out how he's progressed with his instruction and learning to fly. And we'll close out with a little bit of the listener mail. All right, well, let's get started with the aviation news. Are you guys ready?
Ready.
First story comes from Flying Magazine. This is Air Force drone crash closes Florida highway. Well, this was a QF-4 drone, which I guess, David, is a modified F-4 Phantom.
That would be correct. It was either an F-4E or an F-4G. There aren't many of them left. They're going to be replaced by F-16s. Now, folks, I didn't pick this story. This is a Rob Mark proving to people that drones fall out of the sky story.
Oh, I get it now. All right.
Didn't
I tell you that drone would fall out of the sky someday?
You did, but what you failed to say was it was a military aircraft operating in a military zone outside of a military Air Force base. So it's not quite the scenario of you flying into ORD and having a drone show up, but it looks like there was an electronics function, and the QF-4s, unlike most drones, have the ability to explode. They do have self-detonation systems, so if that was actually what caused the aircraft to self-destruct.
Now, the QF-4s are used for target practice, right, David?
Yep. Currently, the QF-4s are designed to be used for anti-aircraft missiles or for F-22s to take out. They're full-size targets. You know, they represent aircraft that
would be in a hostile environment.
And when they're doing that, David, are they maneuvering them from the ground? I mean, they're not just sitting ducks, right? They're not just flying along straight and level.
Yeah, they are. They're flying along pretty much straight and level in the Gulf.
What kind
over
of a challenge can that be for a guy in F-22? Right? Yeah. I mean, I could probably even do that.
You're right, Rob. You probably could. The difference is if you're going to expend a multi-billion-dollar missile, you want it to be able to hit the target. If you want to practice jinking and maneuvering, there's something called Top Gun or Red Flag where you don't necessarily need live things to blow up. I mean, the targets, the drones, the QFs, and soon to be QF-16s, they're designed to primarily designed to test missiles, to make sure the missile impacts properly, or that if you're firing a sidewinder, that it's tracking the infrared portion. When we had QF-100s, they'd actually put large rockets out on the wings so that the heat-seeking missiles would take out those rockets instead and take off a little bit of the wingtip, so we would get more than one use out of the drones. We don't do that anymore with the Phantoms.
Wow.
But in this case, the QF-4's program is rapidly winding down.
Is that because we're running out of them?
We're running out of them. We've blown up several hundred. And we'll start blowing up F-16s because they're a better representation of fifth-generation fighters. You know, F-4s represent third-generation fighters.
Yeah. You know, the one thing, just to finish up on this, the one thing that kind of confused me from the article was it says that the self-destruct feature that you mentioned, David, says it's controlled by a battery with a life of 24 hours. What? 24 hours? The plane can't fly for 24 hours. Why make a big deal about the battery life?
Because basically you arm the aircraft at the end of the runway like you would arm a tactical aircraft. You mean, so you set the thing up to explode on before takeoff in case there's a problem over the Gulf. You don't, right? So a couple of times some of these things have gotten away. There's a couple of stories of F-4s where people have ejected out of them and the airplane has remained straight and level and kept flying and had to be shot down because it was an unmanned aircraft unintentionally. So that's why you have these self-destruct systems. However, if you land the aircraft and you forget to disarm the self-destruct system, having the battery shut off after 24 hours is not a bad thing.
I guess not. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Let's see. Let's move on to the next story. This is from the Houston Chronicle. United's new winglet design for planes expected to save millions. So one of the United 737-800s has been retrofitted with the new winglet. And this is called the split scimitar winglet. So, Rob, you must know what a scimitar is.
Of course.
A scimitar is sort of a curved, large sword, big blade kind of a thing.
Yeah. A sword. I was going to say a swordy thing, but I thought that would sound too stupid.
It's a large, semicircular Arab weapon with reinforced steel that provides extra cutting because of the curved blade. As you slice it across someone's, there you get more surface area. But that's only because I have a degree in military history.
Oh, okay, okay. I didn't want to ask how you knew that, but all right. So these are going to replace the existing winglets on the Dash 800s, and United has announced the Dash 900 ER fleets, and that'll give a 2% fuel savings. They estimate.
And you know why? You know why that's really important to United? Because of course the price of fuel keeps going up, but the other issue, of course, is that they need the extra money to buy toilet paper for those airplanes that go out across the Atlantic and the Pacific.
Yeah, that's true.
I thought this was just because we now Airbus came out with sharklets, so we have to have something other than a sharklet. So now we've got a scimitar. Besides, I think they kind of look cool that they're
they do look cool,
but they're sort of like okay. Airbus has gone to Boeing winglets, and now Boeing is sort of going back to oversized, whatever the things were called on Airbus A320s, because they're on top and the bottom of the wing.
Yeah.
So they're just sort of switching. You know, we if they're going to do that, we're going to do this.
Well, no, but the sharklets are on the Airbuses. They're not on the Boeings.
Right, but Boeing had verticals before Airbus. Airbus had ones that went on the top and the bottom of the wing.
That's true.
Right. So now they've just basically swapped. Airbus is doing tall verticals, and now Boeing is doing tops and bottoms.
All right. We'll put a picture of this in the show notes so that you can take a look at this. I think it's kind of an interesting looking end of a wing.
It's cool.
It is cool. And as for the 2% fuel savings, 2% may not sound like a lot, but in this business, it's a lot. The article points out that if the entire fleet of United 737s, 57s, and 67s were fitted with these, that it would save United $200 million a year in fuel. $200 million. So it's 2% adds up when you're talking about fuel. All right, our last story before we get to our guest interview is from AIN Online. U.S. authorities prepare to order 787 ELT inspections. Now, this relates to the July 12th fire aboard the Ethiopian Airlines 787. That was the one that was parked at London Heathrow. The ELT, that's the emergency locator transmitter. Rob, you want to describe a little about what that means?
Well, sure. An emergency locator transmitter is usually aboard just about every civil airplane that flies anywhere in the world these days, no matter what country made them. It's pretty much an ICAO function in addition to the various aviation authorities. But an emergency locator transmitter is designed to withstand a crash and also to be turned on during a high G-force maneuver like a crash. And it sends out a beacon signal that can be picked up by satellites. And hopefully that will help the search and rescue people find the airplane. And so on the 787, it looks like it went a little flaky a couple of weeks ago.
In the UK Air Accidents Investigation Branch, the AAIB, had authority over this since it occurred at London Heathrow. And they issued some recommendations. The AAIB actually made two safety recommendations. First was that they want to advise the FAA to initiate action to have the 787 operators actually turn this off. And the second recommendation was that the FAA conduct a safety review of these things and other aircraft. Well, the FAA says they plan to order inspections of the wiring associated with these ELTs on the 787s. These are manufactured by Honeywell. And I don't know what else they'll do. It says in the article, an FAA advisory directive scheduled for publication would require inspection for proper wire routing and damaged or pinched wires. The operators would also need to inspect the transmitter's battery compartment for condensation or overheating. And probably the thing that most people thought of when they first heard about this is this the same battery issue with the 787 that we'd seen previously? And every indication is that it is not.
Yeah, that's correct. And of course, one thing that's interesting is that with a few exceptions, you cannot fly an aircraft without an emergency locator transmitter that's operational. So telling everyone they want them to turn them off is great. And certainly we're expecting any day that FAA here in the United States will issue an airworthiness directive against the 787 for the inspections of the wiring. But, you know, over the weekend when this came out, the AAIB told everyone that they should turn off these Honeywell emergency locator transmitters. And Boeing responded, yeah, we agree with you. Except the one part no one explained was, how do you fly the airplanes with no ELTs? And so that's kind of an issue. And so that's why I think FAA is taking the action to speed up the inspection process so they don't have to say, you know, we can't fly these things without ELTs. I mean, it's really a dark corner there.
This is Richard Amalafia, proud to be among the geeks at airplanegeeks.com.
Joining us now is Scott Spangler. Scott's the editor over at jetwine.com. And Scott, you're going to give us a little bit of an AirVenture preview, aren't you?
Yes. You know, the show starts on Monday, which means the airport has just been a flurry of activity. That on Monday, they were painting the dots on the runway and doing the last minute updates and markings there and dealing with broken down lawnmowers, getting the site prepared on the county side of the thing. But they've got
Is there anybody that doesn't know what the dots are? I mean, maybe we could just take a minute to explain that.
Okay. Well, actually, that ties into the whole air traffic control thing. That,
okay, never mind. I'll shut up.
First of all, they repaint taxiway Alpha so it becomes 1836 left or right. And then on the main runway, 927 and 1836, they paint three colored dots. So as the guys in the tower clear them to land, they say land on the specific dot. So it's basically getting three landings at the same time on one runway. But they only do that on the main runways. It's just single flights into the taxiway Alpha that is doing double duty as a runway. But that's one of the reasons they need so many controllers there, because they have, I think, two or three controllers assigned to each of the three active runways that they run as the aerial hordes congregate here in Oshkosh. The first campers showed up today, although the volunteers have been on site since the 1st of June, getting the site ready to go. But they're going to have a real interesting lineup this year. And the one that I want to see the most is the jetman, Ives Rossi, who is supposed to fly. And a buddy of mine who does the program for EAA interviewed Rossi, says he's a hoot, but not a wild man, very controlled, much into risk management. And, you know, he's flown airline and military and the thing. And he says, always have a plan B. And with the wing, and he's on his 23rd iteration of the wing, his plan B is always his parachute, which is why he always launches from a helicopter at least, I think, about 6,000 feet, because that, you know, he trusts his parachute. But working some other stuff, I can't wait to read the story, which will be in the program. The other thing that kind of Pixar's Disney's movie Planes they're going to preview on Friday night at the Ford Theater over there. And I'm looking forward to that. And they've got a an air tractor, I think an AT-400 done up as Dusty, who is the protagonist of the movie. And I understand that it's supposed to be doing some flying during the air shows, which ought to be pretty interesting. The other thing that's kind of captured my fancy that I can't wait to see because I've written about it, often not in a real positive, the Terra Fugia flying car.
Yeah, the Transition.
Yes, the Transition. It's supposed to fly. I'd like to see that. Also, the first public appearance of the Honda Jet.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
this year, which would be good. I'm kind of a Warburg freak, so I'm looking forward to seeing the PV-2D Harpoon, which is one of three left flying in the world. And they're going to do a Warbird and review on that later in the week, which those Warbirds in a review are always good. And same thing with Janet the Gannet, the very British anti-submarine warfare airplane, big chesty turboprop with contra-rotating props.
Wait a minute. Janet the Gannet.
That's the what chesty, they call it.
The chesty turboprop.
That's right.
The double
you're making this up.
No, I'm not. The
double Mamba equipped counter-rotating Ferry Gannet from the Royal Navy.
That's right. Uh-huh. I think the only one flying.
I got to see a picture of this.
It's ugly.
It's a British airplane. You know, they design airframes that only the British can love. but apparently it was quite an effective airplane. So I've only seen pictures and I've read about them. So I'm really anxious to see it in person.
Scott, the ones that I wish I was going this year to see was the fact that they're bringing in the two A4K Skyhawks and the two MB-339s from Florida. The Kiwis are going to be represented.
Hmm. Oh. Now, see, and I have a personal one because they're also going to display the FM-2 that they pulled out of Lake Michigan, the one that didn't quite make the USS Sable where they did the carrier training in Lake Michigan during World War II, and they're going to do a Warbird and review on what it takes to restore one of these airplanes. And I think that's on Thursday at 10 o'clock. But I have a personal interest there because my dad was a naval aviator who carrier called in Lake Michigan on the Wolverine, which was the sister ship to the Sable. So it was kind of interesting. He used to tell stories about it. He'd fly out of Glenview. And the last thing is he did his 180-degree circle and approach to the Wolverine. Is the last thing he saw was the LSO giving him the cut. So he cut the engine and, get set and just hope that what he hit was hard and not wet. Because the entire ship disappeared as he rolled out on final. So it'd be interesting to see one of these airplanes because that's what they all did. Their carrier calls was the Wildcat, which the FM-2, which was the Eastern Aircraft version of the F-4F.
Hey, Scott, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
How did the whole issue with the air traffic controllers work out? Is the EAA paying the FAA the $500,000 for air traffic control?
EAA paid the $487,000 bill for the controllers, but they are fighting it and trying to get it back in a district court someplace. And I have not heard anything either officially or through the Oshkosh grapevine on how that's going. My guess is because it's just an all hands evolution to get the site ready for the show that, they got other things that they're more concerned with, that they'll probably ramp that thing back up once the show concludes. Hmm. Although it will be interesting and kind of on a personal or a political note, is they moved the membership meeting from Saturday morning to Wednesday morning, which means more people can attend. In the 7 years that I worked there, I went to the membership meeting every Saturday morning. And you could count the number of members who attended and who didn't work there without having to take your shoes off.
Wow.
So it will be interesting to see who shows up this year and what they have to say. although I everything, you know, picking up from the grapevine around here, Jack Pelton has been doing an outstanding job in rebuilding the morale and the among the employees there and with the community. So I got my fingers crossed for
him. Okay, good. Anything else? Any other highlights before we press onward?
Oh, yes. Long time. I just saw this the other day when I was going by. Long time Oshkosh veterans will be happy to see that the F-86 is back in its traditional gate guard position.
Where did it go?
Well, about 15 years ago, they took, you know, it was on the main pole, kind of out there in EAA's front yard. And then they replaced it with the lighted Air Venture Museum sign that had the logo with the F-22 up there and the digital scroll, you know, of attractions that was underneath it.
Hmm.
Well, it broke 2 years ago, maybe three. I don't remember the last time I saw the lighted scroll thing up. But when I was driving by the other day, I noticed that it was gone, and they have restored the F-86, and it's back out in its traditional position.
Nah, I would hardly call what they did. They repainted the F-86. If it's an F-86H painted like an F-86D with Paul Poberesny's name on it, that's not restoration.
Well, restored from what it used to look when it was sitting on the stick to the south. No, it's not near where the conditions in any way. But, you know, it looks prettier now. And they put a pilot in there with a helmet and an oxygen mask. And I think they got a light up in the canopy for it at night. I haven't seen it at night yet. And then down on the where it used to be, they put John Marks up on a stick down there. So there's two jets up on sticks in the front yard now.
All right, Scott Spangler, thanks so much for jumping in and giving us a little taste of what's coming up at Air Venture in Oshkosh this year.
Pleasure. Hope to see you all here.
See you, Scott.
See you, Rob.
Thanks,
you
Scott.
Our guest this episode is Lieutenant Colonel Brian Allen. Now, he's with the 146th Airlift Wing, California Air National Guard, Channel Islands Air National Guard Station. Brian, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, good evening. I'm glad to be here.
Now, you're a MAFS qualified pilot. Is that how you say that, MAFS?
It is. MAFS stands for Modular Airborne Firefighting System. We call it MAFS. It's modular because it's actually built on several pallets that we roll into the back of the C-130.
Now, this is something that you can do to sort of modify or specialize the mission for a C-130, right? When there's a call for or need for additional firefighting capacity.
Exactly. So what we do is we've got the system that we've built, we've had built by Aero Union, and it's mounted on three separate pallets that roll into the back of us, just about any C-130. We do modify the aircraft at the four wings that perform the MAFS mission with an electrical interface panel. So the 146th Airlift Wing flies C-130J aircraft, the 145th out of North Carolina, the 153rd out of Cheyenne, Wyoming, and the 302nd out of Colorado Springs all have C-130H aircraft. And each one of our aircraft at the four bases are modified with an electrical interface panel that can accept the plug-in from the MAFS system. So it rolls into the back, we plug it into the aircraft, and away we go.
Now, are these strategically placed around in different locations? Is that how that's sort of the logistics of it is handled?
Yeah, by and large they are. California and Wyoming and Colorado Springs are obviously right in the midst of the predominance of wildfire area in the western region of the United States. And having those three bases in that particular that region allows us quite a reach quite quickly. We also have the one in North Carolina, which I like to call protecting our rear flank. And anything that's out in that area, they can get to quickly. But then we can also have them fly across the country. We've got the entire lower 48 United States pretty well covered for surge capacity for the U.S. Forest Service. Now, remember that our air tankers are used when the commercial air tanker fleet is either unavailable or can't get to the need quickly. In 1971, there were 51 air tankers that dwindled down to 33 air tankers in 2003, and we lost a PBUY-4 and a C-130A that year. And as a result of the Blue Ribbon panel, that air tankers that didn't have a history, a known, well-documented known history of maintenance and flight records, that those aircraft couldn't participate in the federal contracts for heavier tankers. So immediately in 2003, we dropped from 4 air tankers down to 19. And then as time has gone on, the tanker fleet has continued to dwindle down to, there's really 9 legacy aircraft right now left, and they're P2Vs. The Forest Service is trying to bolster that fleet of commercial air tankers by employing some BAE-146 aircraft on top of the what they call a legacy contract, and then they've let the next-gen contract, which they hope will have additional air tankers, additional BAE-146s, RJ-85s, DC-10s, MD-87s, and so on, to bring up the fleet. But because the fleet has diminished to such a low number, the surge capacity of the National Guard and Air Force Reserve C-130s equipped with MAFs has come into play more and more often in recent years.
Interesting. Can you explain some of the details of what the MAFs unit is like? This, I guess this contains or is made up of some pressurized tanks?
Yes. Now, the MAF system, we've been flying MAFs for over 40 years. So there's been two different variants of the MAF systems, and we only use MAF number 2 or MAF version 2 now. The original MAF system was a system that was leveraged on an aerial spray system. You're familiar with Agent Orange. The system that was built in the aircraft, a C-123, I believe it was, that was used to dispense defoliants in the Vietnam era, was used to be used as the basis for the original MAFS 1 system. It was built by the Food Machinery Corporation in response to a U.S. Air Force need to try to put out fires on U.S. Air Force ranges. So back in 1971, they took this spray system and tried and figured out how to dispense more fluid more rapidly, and that fluid being aerial fire retardant. So in 1971, they built the MAF system, and it originally had several pallets. It had air spears that you could pressurize up to about 1,000 pounds or 600 pounds to 1,000 pounds of PSI of air pressure. And it had nozzles that would, you would lower the ramp, open the door, lower the ramp, and these nozzles would be pneumatically lowered into the slipstream behind the aircraft. And there was these large 18-inch butterfly valves that would open when you press the button, and air pressure would force the retardant out the back. See, that system we used until 2009, all the way from 1971 to 2009, very effective system, gave us coverage level 4. Some of the issues were with it were that we couldn't fly pressurized because we opened up the ramp and door, so it was unpressurized flight. That limited how high we could fly. It could only dispense up to coverage level 4, which is 4 gallons per 100 square feet. So if you think of a 10-foot by 10-foot square, we could only cover up to 4 gallons in that 10-foot by 10-foot square. And it also coated the back of the aircraft pretty good with retardant. So there was a need to as a new generation of aircraft were coming on, the C-130J was being looking like it was going to come into the inventory, we decided that we would have the system redesigned into the new next generation MAF system. And so when we did that, we asked Congress to help redesign that system. They gave us the money. And U.S. Forest Service and Air Union designed this new system, which holds 3,000 gallons of retardant. It has 2 high-pressure tanks, which hold between 1,000 and 1,500 pounds of air pressure each. They're actually 2 large natural gas tanks for buses. And they sit on, they buttress this large tank, the main tank. The main tank actually has a volume of 4,000 gallons. We put 3,000 gallons of liquid in it. And on the forward pallet, we have a computer control system and 2 giant compressors, air compressors. And they're electrically driven air compressors that pump up these large fuel tanks. So when we press the button, that high-pressure air moves from the high-pressure tanks to the main tank as we open up a pintle in the back, and it shoots the retardant out the back. The system is controlled by a loadmaster in the back, sets pressures and volumes, coverage levels and how much of the retardant goes out per trigger pull. And the co-pilot actually pulls the trigger as the pilot flies the aircraft.
Hmm. There must be some kind of special training that's required for this.
There is, and we're very selective on the flight crew members that are brought into the program. So the first off is who goes into the program and how do we train them? Because the program is a uniquely risky endeavor, we take pilots that have flown the C-130 for many years. Most of our pilots have flown at least 10 years with the aircraft before they come into the aerial firefighting program. The MAPS mission flies very, very low. We'll take a 165,000-pound airplane. We'll configure it with 100% flaps. We'll fly it at 120 knots at 150 feet above the ground, going down a canyon that's on fire in low visibility behind a lead plane. So those characteristics create an environment of increased risk. So to mitigate that, we accept only pilots that have flown the aircraft for quite a long time. And then we put them through a training program that builds their systems capability and understanding of the whole program and put them into the right seat of the aircraft. So they become a co-pilot. Typically, it's a C-130 instructor pilot or experienced aircraft commander that is then selected to be a co-pilot for the program. It takes about 10 years before you start getting into the MAPS program. From that point forward, we have one week-long program, and we do that each year. We combine a new certification and a recertification program 1 week every year, where we teach all of the ground school, all the characteristics of flight dynamics in the low-level environment that are special and unique to the aerial firefighting environment. We teach mountain flying, fire behavior, retardants, types of retardants, what retardants do, how to apply the retardants, lead plane terminology, forest service type terminology. We teach energy management techniques, all those types of things that would go that an air tanker pilot would be experienced with. We give those during that 1 week course. And then we require each of the co-pilots to go through quite a number of drops. I think it's 24 drops over a period of, 4 to 6 sorties. And then as they build their confidence and time in the aircraft, we require them to be actually a co-pilot for 2 active seasons, and they have to have a number of live drops as a co-pilot before they can upgrade to being an aircraft commander. And that process takes about 2 to 3 years, if not 4 years is typical, to move from the right seat to the left seat. And then another 4 years or so, 3 or 4 years before you become a MAPS instructor pilot.
Gee, that's a lot of experience built up in order to qualify for this. It's pretty impressive.
It is.
Am I correct in guessing that you don't have any shortage of volunteers?
Well, that's true. We don't have any. There's no shortage of volunteers at all, in fact, in this program. We're very selective on which pilots get to fly it, and frankly, not every TAC airlift pilot makes the cut into the program. So. And there's very good reason for that. We make sure that the pilots that are flying the aircraft have impeccable and are some of the best pilots that we have and that can handle that kind of risk level in that stressful environment and do it safely, efficiently, and effectively. So there is no shortage of volunteers to do it. That's true. And it really lends itself extremely well to the reserve component, to the National Guard and to the Air Force Reserve, where pilots stay with that particular wing for quite a long time. Like, for example, I've been in the California Air National Guard for over 24 years, and I've flown the HERC for over 20 years, mixture between the C-130E and the C-130J. And I would have to say that the average Air Force age of our pilots is probably, for MAPS at least, is 15 years in our unit.
Wow.
And I think that's pretty much the same amongst the Air Force Reserve and the rest of the other 2 Air National Guard units.
Yeah, that's impressive.
Max, I got one?
Yes, sure. Go ahead, David.
Okay, here's the technical question of the day, Colonel. What's a better aircraft for MAPS, the Hotel or the Juliet? How do they differ?
Well, and that's a good question. If I have to say the C-130J, one, because I fly it and I'm in love with it, but really because it has the power necessary it simply has more power. Over the E model to the J model, we have 29% more thrust, which is a significant power advantage. And when you're down in the canyon and you're heavyweight and you have a malfunction on an engine, and you are looking at an environment where you have a need to climb out of a canyon in three engines, then you want every lick of energy you've got. So just simply on the power capability of the C-130J versus the H, it's significantly different. So the J definitely has an advantage in its performance. The J also has an electronic suite for navigation and flight communications and systems monitoring that the H doesn't have. The H has the flight engineer and the navigator, which are good, but the J model can graphically lay out the fire environment, the air attack plan. It can overlay all digitally. It can overlay where the lead aircraft are, where the other air tankers are, all over the map of where the fire is. So graphically in the navigation system, it's got an advantage. Additionally, the C-130J has the HUD, the heads-up display. And it's a focused infinity HUD, very much similar to an F-16, except that it's both pilots have the HUD, and all of the performance information that you would need for firefighting is presented out in front of you. So where a H-model pilot has to have his cross-check in a typical cross pattern or sweep pattern down through the instrument panel and airspeed and configuration engines and so on. With a J model, everything is done for you looking out into the HUD. You've got your altitude, airspeed, terrain avoidance, TCAS avoidance, your performance indications, everything is displayed out in focus infinity. So you can actually watch the lead plane pilot and the fire and the drop as you never look down. You just simply always look through the HUD. Makes a huge difference. Additionally, the engines on the C-130 are controlled by FedEx, and they automatically handle all sorts of different types of input to the aircraft. On the C-130H, you have to be careful about not over torquing the engines, especially on takeoff on a cold day or a cool day. But on the J model, because the FedEx runs the motors, you can slam the throttles forward if you had to, and it will handle getting the engines as much thrust as quickly as possible without overboosting or over torquing the props. So it's quite a nice aircraft, and I have to say, flying the two of them, it's quite a race car comparative to the E model.
Are your J stretches? Do you get extra capacity?
Yeah, well, most all of the aircraft in the U.S. Air Force inventory that are J models are stretches. There's a few of them when they first came off the line that were H model airframes converted to J's. And those are basically now at the Little Rock Air Training Base. And so almost all of the aircraft that come off the line for the U.S. Air Force are all stretches, including ours. We, Rhode Island, are the two National Guard units that have C-130Js. Little Rock, Dias, and Ramstein have Js. And they're all the employment ones, the ones that you would see that go over to Iraq, Afghanistan, and pretty much go around the world, are all stretches. Yeah, it's kind of nice, too, that it gives you a little extra room. The C-130, the MAF unit in the H model, consumes that entire cargo bay, where in the C-130J, there's about 5 feet forward and about 6 feet aft of the MAF unit. It gives you a little more room in the back.
Now, your unit has been involved, I think, in the fires that we've seen recently in Arizona. Weren't you deployed to that?
Yes, the most recent activation was a state activation just this last week, and ended up they finished it up yesterday when the monsoon rain came into the mountain fire in the Idlewild area in Southern California. You may have seen the city of Idlewild was evacuated. Very large fire there, just due west of Palm Springs in the Mount San Gregorio Mountains. We dropped there about 40 drops, about 12,000 gallons over about 3 days, 3.5 days of flying. Very quick reaction to CAL FIRE's request. We have over this summer already been activated by federally through NITSE, the National Interagency Fire Center, federally, and we have been fighting the fires in Colorado and Arizona. I was up in Colorado. We start off, I think it was with a Springs fire, which burned 500 and some odd homes just north and east of the city of Colorado Springs. The 302nd, because they were right there in Colorado Springs, they were requested to be on the fire as quickly as possible. They got on the fire within 12 hours, which is very, very quick for a federal activation. Mm. And they assisted in trying to in mitigating the fires there in Colorado Springs. And then we moved off to the fires into the West Fork Complex, just due west of Colorado Springs, the mountains, about halfway between Durango and Colorado Springs. I was flying on those. There's some YouTube videos out there. If you search on YouTube, MAFS 4 and Papoose, you'll see me flying. My co-pilot, Luke Trower, and I were flying there in Colorado on those fires. I was able to connect the intercom to the GoPro camera, and you'll see some pretty interesting videos of the low-level environment there. And then as soon as the fires started to really get going in Arizona, we were actually dispatched to the fire where the 19 firefighters were killed. And right as before we could load retardant, they canceled the request because of that thunderstorm that came in. And so we sat out, and then we shift changed. So I rotated out, new guys came in that evening, and then they were deployed down to Arizona, where they subsequently dropped retardant on a number of fires there in Arizona. Hmm. Right now we've got MAFS activated federally, and they're stationed in Boise. There's two federal aircraft. One from Wyoming and one from North Carolina. They're stationed out of Boise, and they're flying on fires in Idaho.
Colonel, how quickly between drops, what's the time frame from when you've maybe released to landed, gotten the tank fueled up again? What kind of time frames are we talking about?
Well, it depends. If you're fully self-contained, if you're the onboard air compressors are pumping up your own air, I like to say from drop to drop, it should be 30 minutes. And that's about a minimum. If we have ground-based air compressors like we have in some locations, you can cut that down to about 20 minutes drop to drop. Most recently, the first fire that we started this year, which was the Springs fire we dropped on, was in California. And it was Camarillo Springs fire in Southern California, which is, you could see it from Channel Islands Air National Guard Base. You could see that fire, and we were able to rotate our aircraft from drop to drop in about 12 minutes. So that's very, very fast. Depending upon the air tanker base we go to, it can range anywhere between 15 to 20 minutes to 30 minutes to get a retardant and air on the aircraft.
That is so impressive. It really is. I think that's fantastic. Now, Colonel, you mentioned YouTube. I discovered that 146th actually has a pretty significant presence on the internet. There's a web page, which I'll give folks the address of that. It's www.146aw.ang.af.mil. But you guys also have a Twitter ID, 146 Airlift Wing.
And we also have a Facebook page, an official Facebook page. And the YouTube videos are, I posted under my account, but they are approved. The ones that are on there approved for release. You can see those, and some of those are actually linked on from our own Facebook account. Additionally, the 145th AEG, it's a military group, but we changed the number. We swap it between each of the one of the four wings. So there's the 145th AEG for Wildland Firefighting, and they have a Facebook page, and that's where you can get, if you like that link, then you'll get the feeds each day about what kinds of things we're doing each day. And so I would recommend both on the Facebook page for the 146th Airlift Wing and for the 145th AEG Wildland Firefighting, you can actually get a really good idea of what the MAFS aircraft are doing.
That's fantastic. And we'll put all the links in the show notes so that people can just click right through to them.
Wonderful. This media, this internet technology has allowed us to really get the message out about what the capabilities are for the MAFS program and how the Air National Guard and Air Force Reserve really contribute to civil support missions, especially within the United States. It's really kind of a nice way of getting communications out.
Are you ever called to support fires in Canada or other places, or is it strictly in the U.S.?
We've been requested and have gone several different countries. Canada actually isn't one of them. I don't think we've ever been asked to go up to. They've got a good, robust tanker program through Coulson Aviation and some of their own Canadian air tankers up there. But Western men have dropped in countries such as Greece, Italy, Indonesia. We were requested to go to Israel. I actually got to go on that one as the advanced party, but they were able to get the fire out before we got there. And so it's something that is, and in Mexico, the most one of the more recent ones was the Mexican firefighting operation we ran out of Del Rio, Texas, out of Laughlin Air Force Base, which was my UPT base. Hmm. Got to go back there, and we had the two C-130s flying into Mexico with a U.S. Forest Service lead plane, and and dropping on fires near ranches out in the northern Mexico area. And we saved hundreds and hundreds of cattle and several ranches, quite a few houses out in Mexico for them. It was quite a neat endeavor. And that was the year we also had some of the large fires in Texas, in Austin and in Abilene. So we've been all over the world.
This has to be incredibly satisfying work.
You know, it really is. I have to say that with the C-130, you get to go into foreign countries and do battle, which is really a interesting endeavor. It's gratifying that you use the skills that you were trained for as an Air Force pilot. But on the home front, when you actually do something that saves lives or saves cattle, or saves livestock, saves homes, that's especially gratifying because you can see the direct impact on the American populace. You can see the houses that you've saved or the cattle you've saved. I recall dropping on a fire in the eastern portion of Idaho where there were probably 250, maybe 300 head of cattle that were all scrunched up against a fence line in a corner of a range. And they were bunched up in a triangular pattern trying to get through that fence as the fire was approaching them. And I laid a retardant line from fence line to fence line behind the cattle and came back and the fire had stopped and the cattle were actually walking in the black, which was extremely gratifying to know that 250 to 300 head of cattle were alive because of that one drop that day. And I've dropped on houses, I've dropped on dozers, it's really neat to see where the fire simply stops and the homes and things that are saved because of it. And that direct connection to the American people is just something you can't put a price on. It's just extremely satisfying. Now, it's important to note that retardant that we drop doesn't always put the fire out. Most often, we have to have ground firefighters there to be a really effective fighting force. We slow it down so that the guys on the ground that are really the true heroes about firefighting really have the capability of putting the fire out. Very, very rare is it that we can actually stop completely the fire without having any kind of ground support.
It's kind of a team effort.
It really is, and that's that team effort, that the ability to speak their language and have them understand what our capabilities are is really the synergistic capability that we've got to build when we do our training. As we start out in the firefighting world and we do it year after year after year, we get better at it. And we get better at our understanding what a Type 1 tanker is and a Type 1 dozer and a Type 2 dozer and what a head of a fire is, the heel, the flank, and all the terminology that you hear over the radio. And all those kinds of things really come into play when you're dealing with ground firefighters that have the ability to lay line, lay hose line, or a dozer has the cut line, and you work in coordination with those types of resources to build a war plan against the fire. It's just fantastic.
Colonel, one of the things that we always talk about on the show is careers in aviation. Can you just talk a little bit about your career in the Air National Guard and any other flying, how you got to be so lucky to fly 130s every day?
And I really am lucky. Providence had quite a bit to do with it. I come from a family of aviators. My dad flew in the United States Air Force back in the 50s and flew for American Airlines for 34 years. Both my brothers are C-130 pilots. Both of them are retired. They both now fly for FedEx. One flies the MD-11 and the other flies the 777. I was lucky enough to be selected and went off to pilot training back in 1991. And I got back, flew co-pilot in the C-130E for a number of years. An opportunity opened up for me to get hired by American Airlines myself, which I did back in 1998. I flew 727 flight engineer, 737, 757, 767 with American. And then when I was called to go to the war in 2003, I was also I went off to do war in Iraq, and then I came back to a full time job in Operation Enduring Freedom. So I was able to come back and do and fly for the Guard home station full time, and took military leave from American Airlines. And then as time went on, I got close enough to within striking range of an actual retirement with the Air National Guard. I'm within 2 years, I have the opportunity, if I choose to retire, I could, and then go right back to American Airlines flying 767s to Hawaii. So as a career, I don't think it can be beat. You know, my dad said that there's somewhere in the world there will always be a job for a pilot. It may not be in your neighborhood, may not be in your country, but somewhere in the world there's always a job for a pilot. And the other thing he told me is you simply can't beat the view from the office. So those two things kind of made my path, I think. And I think for folks that are thinking about an aviation career, right now is an absolute excellent time to think about the Air National Guard and its career paths, its ability to get you flight training, its ability to give you education benefits, and those things will be rewarding to you, not only in helping you through school, but also giving you the capability and the ratings that you would need to fly airplanes. So the Air National Guard, to me, is one of probably the best areas that you could be in for flight training. It's certainly a lot cheaper than trying to fund your own civilian flight training, flight school. My son has soloed and has found that it's extremely expensive to try to pay for his own flight time. And the Air National Guard is a path that for many is a great way to go. And it's really an undiscovered source. Many people don't realize what the Air National Guard is the premier aviation flying club in the world, I guess you could say. And the Air National Guard, it is the United States Air Force training, United States Air Force rank, United States Air Force pay on a part-time basis, on a base that you pick for your career. And it's a fabulous way to get great flight training, to be around airplanes, to do all sorts of different things. And even if you don't want to fly, you want to bend wrenches on an engine, you want to fix prop blades, you want to, if your expertise is in landing gear, if you're into communications, radio communications and navigation systems, you just can't beat the different types of disciplines that the Air National Guard and the United States Air Force have to offer. And all of those skills are technical skills that can be used on the outside. I mean, for example, in the Air National Guard, quite most of our pilots are commercial airline pilots as well. So, and the hiring for commercial airlines is just really going to it's forecast to really accelerate here. So, a bunch of our younger pilots that have just gotten through training are really looking to build time to get hired by an airline. And you can fly for pay for a major airline and fly for fun with the National Guard, and that's really paid out for us, and for me specifically.
Yeah, sounds like a great life. Sounds like a great career.
I'm pretty lucky.
Yes, yeah, very. I wish I could be so lucky. that sounds like this is a terrific career. Very good. Anything else that Colonel that you wanted to bring up with our audience?
If anybody has any further questions, they can get a hold of me through you, I'm sure.
Very good.
I'm happy to help.
All right. Well, we'll let you go and enjoy the rest of your vacation. Again, we want to thank you so much, Lieutenant Colonel Brian Allen, for taking a brief break from your vacation to talk with us about some really exciting and rewarding stuff. So thank you very much.
And thank you for your service, Colonel.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. And you guys are quite welcome.
And now with his aircraft of the week, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. The Airplane Geeks airplane of the week, the XF-84H Thunder Screech. Jets guzzle jet fuel. Early in the 50s, the Navy wanted a high-speed turboprop fighter capable of launching off the deck of an aircraft carrier without a catapult. The Air Force's Wright Air Development Center put out a request for a turboprop aircraft with a supersonic propeller. Republic answered with Project 3347. The contract was for three airframes. The U.S. Air Force designated the aircraft the XF-106. The 106 designator was dropped in favor of XF-84H, showing that it was part of the F-84 family of aircraft. Only two aircraft were built when the Navy dropped out of the project. An RF-84F Thunderflash was modified with an Allison XT-40A1 turboprop engine just rear of the cockpit. The shaft for the propeller ran to the nose, which housed a prop and a streamlined nose cone. The turbine was supported by wing-mounted intakes. The XT-40 could generate 5,850 horsepower. We've talked about the T40 before when we talked about the R3Y Tradewind in episode 227, Advancing the Pilot Community. It was a terrible engine. What made the T40A1 different was the exhaust was pushed out through the rear and could be reheated. In American Ease, the aircraft had an afterburner. This would further increase the thrust to 7,230 horsepower. However, it was never tested in flight. The XT40 would drive a three-bladed, each 12-foot long, with square tips, Aero Products propeller. The constant speed prop could reach Mach 1.8 at the tips. The torque of the propeller caused all sorts of changes to the airframe from the standard RF-84F. The left wing intake was extended 12 inches more forward on the left side than the right. The aircraft was fitted with left and right differential flaps, causing the left and right to act independently. The propeller had a significant P factor on takeoff. To compensate for this, the aircraft was given a yaw vane on the spine of the aircraft, and the traditional tail of the F-84 was changed to a T-tail to get the control surfaces out of the propeller prop wash. This provided clean air over the surfaces versus turbulent. The X-84H was the first aircraft to have a deployable RAT, or ram air turbine. The ram air turbine could be deployed in case of an engine failure. The forward speed of the airstream could develop hydraulic and electrical power. The XT-40s were so bad, quite often the XF-84H flew with the RAT deployed from takeoff to landing. Two prototypes were created, 51-170059 and 51-170060, and given the buzz numbers FS-059 and FS-060. They were built at the Republic factory in Farmingdale, Long Island. They were then disassembled and shipped to Edwards Air Force Base by train and reassembled. On July 22, 1955, the first XF-84H took to the skies. The pair of aircraft would fly a total of 6 hours and 40 minutes over 12 flights. Republic test pilot Lynn Hendricks flew the first flight and, once on the ground, refused to fly the aircraft ever again. The remaining flights were flown by Hank Beard. Of those 11 flights, 10 of them required emergency landings. The aircraft over 450 knots would have severe longitudinal stability issues. The vibrations were so bad, the lines would break. But if that wasn't bad enough, the aircraft was the loudest single-engine aircraft in history. Only the Tupolev Tu-95 Bear is as loud, and that has four engines. It was said that ground run-ups could be heard 25 or 40 kilometers away. Keep in mind that 2.5 feet of each blade was supersonic, causing a continuous sonic boom that radiated out of the propeller even at idle. The sound could knock someone down. It was known to cause headaches and nausea from the vibrations and sonic dissonance. One Republic engineer was known to have a seizure from the propeller shock waves. If it could do that to a person, imagine what it could do to 50s electronics. Radios were not about to function in the control tower when it was running. Eventually, Edwards made Republic tow the aircraft to the opposite side of Rogers Dry Lake before doing any sort of engine running. The ground crew used light signals to communicate to the pilot. From all of this, the aircraft earned the name of the Mighty Ear Banger, or eventually Thunder Screech. The XF-84H would eventually achieve a top speed of 520 miles per hour, or Mach 0.70. This made the aircraft the fastest single-engine propeller-driven aircraft in the world. The record held until August 21, 1989, when an F-8F Bearcat racer, Rare Bear, reached a top speed of 528.33 miles per hour, or Mach 0.71. The program was canceled in 1956. FS-060 was scrapped for its engine, and it went into the Douglas A2D Skyshark. FS-059 was put out on a plinth. I love that word, plinth. Okay, it was put on a stick at Meadows Field Airport in Bakersfield, California.
What was that
BFL.
Word?
BFL. Plinth.
How do you spell that?
P-L-I-N-T-H.
Oh, okay.
As a nice touch, it was given an electric motor to leisurely spin the propeller. In 1982, the Thunder Screech was acquired by the Ohio National Guard's 178th Fighter Wing. After 3,000 hours of restoration, the aircraft was given to the National Museum of the United States Air Force Research and Development Gallery, where it's there currently on display. If we didn't have sequester, you could actually see it there. If you want to hear how loud the aircraft was, we'll put a link in the show notes. So congratulations to our Commonwealth listeners on the birth of their new heir. And this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Wow. Thanks, David. That whole idea seems like it was kind of a mistake.
Thunder Screech. I like the name, though.
It's kind of a different name.
David, was there ever a Thunder Chicken?
No, that, well, sort of. All of Republic aircrafts had the name Thunder attached to it, starting with the P-47 Thunderbolt. The Thunder Chief, commonly known as the Thud, was sometimes known as the Thunder Chicken. But the Thunder Flash was the RF-84. The Thunder Jet was the F-84G. So they all had Thunder in it because that's what Republic or Seversky aircraft originally thing. So Thunder Screech was a natural progression out of it, sort of fit, but it was a debilitating noise. And if anyone's ever heard a TU-95 Bear, this makes that look like it's got a muffle system.
Wow. Cool.
All right. So here's my question. What do you get when you put an Australian and a Kiwi together?
Roux on the Barbie.
You get the Australia desk.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia news desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 22nd of July, 2013.
Good Lord, Grant, what are you yawning for? I'm the one who set the record this morning. I was up before you, and I don't think that's ever happened.
Normally, the only time that you're up at the same time I am in the morning is when you're going to bed and I'm waking up.
Yes, yes. Big career changes for me this week. Well, not a career change, but change of work schedule. Grant, did you know that there's 2 3 o'clocks in the day?
Yes, I do know that. In fact, I'm quite intimate with both of them because it's not uncommon for me to be up early, especially in summer, getting ready to go fly balloons at that time.
Yeah, well, I had no idea people drove trains at that time of the day. Good Lord. Anyway, it's most disturbing. But welcome, folks, to episode 258's Australia Desk. Well, let's not talk about my trauma of getting up early. Let's talk about the wonderful thing that is new airport construction, and it looks like that's going ahead up there in Toowoomba in Queensland.
It's certainly going ahead privately. Local family up there who run a bunch of construction equipment, conveniently, that we have spoken about in past AusDesk episodes, are progressing with the construction of their very own massive runway that will be large enough to allow 747s to land. And in fact, they reckon they could even put a heavy lift Antonov in there every day of the week. It's going to be great for them and could be great for the future, but a couple of the locals don't seem to agree, do they, mate?
They don't seem particularly happy. You know, of course, there's always going to be people that are unhappy about things like this. I mean, let's face it, building an airport in this area, which is a very quickly growing area, it's doing very well out of the resources boom here in Australia at the moment, and it's much needed. They've already got a pretty good airport there, but having this one here at Wellcamp, built by the Wagner family, will certainly be a great boon to that area. As you said, Grant, we reported now some of the locals are feeling a bit left out and are even accusing the local Toowoomba Regional Council of a sleight of hand to assist the Wagner family to circumvent regulations that would normally apply to airports around the country, according to this article here in theaustralian.com.au.
Look, the Wagners point out that they definitely did pull every string known to man to get people to understand it was a real project, but they reckon the development was given industrial zoning more than a decade ago and the proper process has been followed.
But no doubt there'll be more to come on this front. Meanwhile, the airlines seem interested.
Virgin Australia says here, as a key aviation stakeholder, Virgin Australia welcomes the opportunity to provide input in the new infrastructure developments, such as the Wellcamp Airport currently under construction. A nameless Virgin Australia spokesman said, and Qantas also said that it's quote-unquote an impressive project, and said that Qantas regularly considers new routes and infrastructure opportunities that could be commercially viable. Well, I guess, Grant, as I mentioned, it is a resources area, and it will be viable because there'll be a lot of fly-in, fly-out workers, I would assume, flying right in and out of that airport. sport.
I'm pretty sure you're right there. But one of the best quotes I've heard in the whole thing was where he talks about how in due course it might make a return, but it may not happen in my lifetime. My kids will do well out of it, and the grandkids will do really well if they don't sell it or muck it up.
Yes, that's very interesting, Grant. In fact, I'm quite familiar down here with some other transport companies here in Melbourne that had quite the same situation, generationally speaking. In fact, I used to work for one of them, and so does my wife currently work for one, so there you go. So that's quite interesting. So, yeah, good to see that this investment is going ahead. We need more infrastructure investment in aviation in this country, so that's good to see. Now, Grant, something else that's good to see is PCDU members getting up and flying with the Royal Australian Air Force in Hercules. You know, Grant, I could mention the time that I flew in a C-130H, but... We've had another team member up this week flying over Sydney in a Royal Australian Air Force C-130J, and it wasn't me or Grant. Yes, it wasn't you, Grant. It wasn't me. It was, of course, our good friend and team member, Kathy Mexted, and she was up there to celebrate the 70th anniversary of Number 37 Squadron, which is the squadron that operates the Hercules for the RAF. So that's a great milestone to pass.
That's awesome, but I thought they were putting the flight on just for her.
Well, you know, we do have some good connections there at the RAF. They do look after us, that's for sure.
Yes, but as it turns out, it was Kathy and a number of other folks from the media. Once again, a pair of Hercules flying across Sydney Harbour. And in this case, Kathy was in the photo ship. So she was in the front. She tells us that it was a little lumpy and she was kind of happy when the ramp went down and a bit of airflow came through, I guess. But it was great that we were able to get her on the flight. And of course, one of the benefits of being part of PCDU is if we get these opportunities and you and I can't jump all over them, well, hey, you usually wind up finding one of the team who's in the right place at the right time. And this was Kathy's turn. And all I can say is, yeah, great. That's Steve. That's Kathy. And well, you know, now we've got Damien Rose. Looks like he's going to get a C-17 flight tomorrow with the United States Air Force up at Exercise Talisman Sabre. So all I can say for this is, mate, roll on my F-18 flight.
Absolutely. Well, 37 Squadron, as I mentioned, operates the Hercules for the Air Force here. Obviously, a much smaller squadron since the departure of the C-130H fleet. They've only got 12 C-130Js left now, and those aircraft are doing a lot of work. Of course, they have been supplemented by the C-17s that are operating out of RAF Base Amberley. 37 Squadron was established on 15th of July 1943 at RAF Base Laverton, which is down here in Victoria, as an air transport unit, and it flies tactical airlift missions with those aircraft, and as I say, they go all over the planet with them. So well done to those guys, and here's to another 70 years, I say.
I think it's great that they've been such a fine, upstanding squadron for so long, and it's also awesome that they're running your favourite aircraft, the Hercules.
Absolutely. You know, Grant, some might say that at Christmas time, people in the Defence Force scram to other places.
Oh,
like how I did that, buddy.
Groan. Can I say no? Because it was, yeah, well done on the segue, but ow.
Oh, okay then. Aussie scramjet to unlock hypersonic travel secrets, screams this headline here in the Australian.com.au. A scramjet? That's very cool.
Yeah, mate. Supersonic combustion ramjet. It's absolutely awesome. Ramjet, as we've had discussed on the Airplane Geeks a number of times, operates by compressing air into the combustion chamber and igniting it. There's no real moving parts. It's all just designed to compress the air by flow. Well, the scramjet does the same thing, but the combustion occurs at supersonic air flows within the combustion chamber, which is pretty sexy stuff. This team from University of Queensland are going to go to Norway and they're going to blast their scramjet on a suicide mission.
Oh,
it's apparently being billed as the $14 million kamikaze mission to yield just 3 seconds of data.
Unbelievable. In September, rockets will propel the 1.8 meter scramjet to an altitude of 340 kilometers, which is out of the Earth's atmosphere. It's a long
just
way
a tad.
Up. Yeah. It says, this article then says it will plummet back towards Earth, accelerating to Mach 8, which is around 8,600 kilometres per hour, before it disintegrates over the sea. So, boy, it's hoped that the precious seconds of data the jet yields will be a small step on the long road to hypersonic travel. When passengers, it says here, might zip from Australia to South Africa in 45 minutes. I'll tell you what, Grant, even I'd go to South Africa if it only took 3/4 of an hour.
I think we're a very, very long way off seeing any passengers on scramjets. Hypersonic travel, great for missiles, great for maybe carrying a few packages or observation and so on, but otherwise not really great for passengers at this stage. But who knows, they may get it sorted out, and the old joke of for half the flight the toilet's not working and the other half it's not available, but I'm sure they'll figure something out about it. But you know, I don't know why they're bothering to accelerate it up to Mach 8. I mean, I've built aircraft models that I just threw them and they disintegrated within 3 seconds. I mean, hello.
That's right, Grant, there's a consultancy beckoning for us.
I think so.
Absolutely, but if you put it on top of your car, the way you drive, no, we won't say that.
It won't last 3 seconds if we do that.
Unbelievable. Well, if it was like my car, it'd disintegrate just sitting in the driveway, but that's a whole nother story for another week.
Yeah, well, that's because of the possums in your trees, mate.
Well, that's very true, and it's just a shame they're a protected species.
Yeah, well, it's one thing to be able to go and hunt and eat grues. It's another thing with possums. They're so cute.
Let's not get Rob excited about that.
Giving him another cute and fluffy Australian mammal that he can be all excited about.
We could take a possum on Port Virgin, Australia, and get frequent flyer points for him.
Oh, we could pretend that he's a fluffy cat.
Well, enough of that silliness for this week. We'll be back next week. Until then, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm going to scram because I'm Grant McCarran.
Yeah, scram. Let's scram. I'm going to scram and get another coffee, I think.
I scram, you scram. We all scram for hypersonic jets.
Yay, that works. And you didn't like my joke. Gee whiz.
Well, I mean, you know.
All right.
You know,
those guys are very strange.
You know, at some point, I'm just going to have to tell Vischer that he's still only got 25% of the C-130 flights I've had in my life. But I don't want to rub that in. Sorry.
Yeah. You've done a lot of rubbing on that topic in the past. Here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
Phoenix Approach, Skyhawk 54288, Firebird Lake, 3,500 feet with Romeo for full stop at Cutter.
Skyhawk 54288, Phoenix Approach, Squawk 5335.
5335, that's Skyhawk 288.
Number 54288, square to contact for Lake, cleared into the Class Bravo airspace heading 290.
Cleared into the Bravo airspace heading 290, Skyhawk 288.
288 advised when he has status information, Sierra, expect runway 7 right.
I'm going to go ahead and get Sierra now, 288. I will advise.
This is Neil.
It is, yeah. Hey, how you doing?
Today, we welcome back Neil Braden, our adopted general aviation pilot, who we last spoke to back in episode 214 about gaining his license and flying in Arizona. Neil, welcome back across the pond.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, Neil, you've had some great flying experiences since passing your check ride. Tell us a little bit about what flying you've got in after we last spoke.
Well, what a great question. I've had so many wonderful flights. Everyone who's been following me know what a blast I'm having over here in the US, you know, including flying into beautiful Sedona and landing at Flagstaff, my first 7,000 MSL airport. But I think I have three highlighted flights that I want to mention. The first one has to be my overnight trip as a PIC, you know, the pilot in command, where I flew into Luka Air Force Base for the 2012 civil fly-in.
And you were one of the very few to get into that. It's a limited number, isn't it?
Yeah, we had about, I think there were about 200 people in total, but they allowed 40 planes to land over the 2 days. And I flew in 54288, the rented Cessna 172 out of Chandler. And we spent 2 days with the F-16 pilots talking about how to fly safely around Phoenix while they're navigating in and out of the MOAs for Luke Air Force Base.
Wow.
I meant to fly with a friend of mine, but he pulled out at the last minute, which meant it was very early on in after my PPL, and here I was on final to Luke Air Force Base.
Yeah.
Just truly amazing experience. I think one of the highlights had to be the sim session. So we all got 0.2 hours in our logbook on the F-16 simulator there.
Yeah.
And that was just truly amazing.
Excellent.
Another flight which I really enjoyed, a lot of people followed me on, is the short trip in from Chandler to Phoenix Sky Harbor, which most people knows within the Class Bravo airspace. So that flight is only 12 to 15 minutes for myself, but flying in and seeing the 737 and 757s parallel on the runway has just been an amazing experience.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. Gives me the wow factor just thinking about that one now. And then the other one, which I've been to several times, is Tucson Airport, south of Phoenix. There's something just about sharing the traffic pattern with an F-16 or an A-10. And that's one place I'm truly missing at the moment, is being able to fly down to Tucson. It's some really great memories from flying into there.
Yeah, and you've moved slightly to slightly less sunnier climes now. You're further north. What's the flying like there in Oregon?
It's green and it's wet. But I guess that that really shouldn't be a surprise. I've had four or five flights here in total now. I got checked out of a place called Twin Oaks, which is just south of southwest of Portland International.
Yeah.
I was going to fly out to Hillsborough, but they were wanting too much money from me. So I found this little gem of a place called Stax Twin Oaks, a privately owned airstrip. Out of all the flights I've taken so far, I think I've only spoken to ATC once. So you can see the airspace structure.
Yeah.
Is completely different to what it was in Arizona. But I'm really enjoying exploring the Pacific coastline and adding on some airports to my logbook.
Now, Oshkosh is just around the corner, and you're going, aren't you? I know you're very excited. What are you looking forward to most?
Oh, man, there's so much to do there. I thought about during the week about making myself a schedule. Yeah. I think it's going to be so big that if any time I put on a schedule, it's just going to go out the window. I think I'm in for a big surprise when I get there. I've read about it as a kid in Pilot magazine back in the UK. I always looked at the pictures and thought, well, I'm never going to go there. And here I am. I'm flying there. I'm going to give Chris a big shout out from In the Pattern podcast. He's actually going to be flying with me. I've got to know Chris through all the flying in Phoenix, and we're going to be flying up together on the same flight from Phoenix Gateway. So I haven't actually been to, with all the flying that I've been doing in the US, I haven't actually been to an air show since I've really been here, apart from a couple of small ones. So I'm actually really looking forward to just seeing some flying. I do miss air shows like Waddington, which I know was on a couple of weeks ago, and Riot coming up. I really actually do miss the air shows. I'm looking forward to the night air show. A lot of people have told me to go and visit that one. And I believe on the Friday there's a Tara 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 display, which also I'm really looking forward to. Also, the Jetman, I believe, is going to be there.
Oh, yeah, and, okay, yeah.
And the Planes movie is going to be the new Disney Pixar movie is going to be aired a week earlier. So I'm looking forward to that. And I think most of all, and you hear it every single time, it's going to be about the people.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who have already met through social media, and there's a lot of people, the podcasts I've been listening to for the last 5 to 10 years that are going to be there.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to seeing them and also the people who I met at AOPA last year.
Well, I think our very own Rob Mark will be there, so do look him up. I'm sure he'll be lording it up somewhere. But after Oshkosh, what's your plan after that? Are you planning to continue to stay in the States for a while, or when will we see you back in the UK?
So I'll be back in Europe in about 12 months' time, so I still have a little bit more flying left to go. A lot of people keep on pestering me about my IFR ticket, and I've announced it again now. It's currently on hold. Let's see what the new year brings. I'm enjoying flying in Oregon. There's still plenty of VFR days remaining up until the autumn. Yeah, over the winter, weather's going to be an issue. One of my original goals was 100 hours PIC. I'm currently sitting at 95 hours.
Yeah.
So for my 100-hour flight, I'm going to fly from Twin Oaks up to Boeing Field.
Wow.
And do a tour of the Boeing Museum. So I'll be taking that flight probably a week or two after Oshkosh, which I'm quite excited about. And to be honest, there's hundreds of little airports I could be visiting in the region as well. So have no fear, there'll be lots of flying between now and when the weather closes in. And as I say, instrument ticket will be something to consider, I think, in the new year. Yeah, one of my biggest flights after Oshkosh, apart from the 100-hour flight, is going to be my parents are coming over from Scotland to see me, and I'm yet to take my dad flying.
Wow.
So I'll be planning a flight with him. I'm probably going to go up the Columbia River Gorge and out that way east of Portland over the hills. And I'm quite excited about that one.
Oh, excellent stuff. Okay, well, Neil, we'll continue to follow you, watch the Twitter feed, the Facebook page, and of course the blog as well. Where can we follow you online, just so everyone's got those details?
So people can find me on Twitter. The handle is pilot_NGB, November Golf Bravo, or visit my website, which is getmyppl.blogspot.com.
Excellent, Neil. Thank you very much again for joining us.
Thank you, and I'll talk to you again soon.
06 Pop, F-16s are now 1 o'clock, 1 mile, 3600. Miller 1, traffic a mile west, your position maneuvering an Archer at 4500. Other VFR aircraft calling, that's taking your call sign.
Cessna 54288.
54288, Roger Squawk 0265.
CO2 65288.
54288. Say your destination. You're coming into Luke 2.
Yeah, Luke approach. Have information Yankee for a full stop for the civil flying.
Roger. What's your type aircraft?
Cessna 172. 288.
Copy. Thank you.
This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Okay, that would be really cool coming in with an F-16 on your wing into Luke.
Yeah, I think so.
It's probably the only time you can say it would be cool to have an F-16 on your wing.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, that should be fun. I hope I get to see Neil up there. Hope
yeah, that'd be great. Even if you are kind of, what do you say, lording about or something?
Yeah, I like that comment. Lording about.
Not looking around.
Aviation media has long been the domain of the newspapers and magazines.
Well, not anymore. I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran, and we're bringing aviation right into your radio.
Yes, we're making aviation cool and interesting for everyone.
Hang on, aviation's always been cool. Check this out.
How cool is this?
Grant, turn that down. At the Plane Crazy Down Under radio show, we've got pilots, engineers, air traffic controllers, industry leaders, even politicians dropping by to chat with us about the amazing world of aviation.
Wow, that's cooler than I thought, mate.
The Plane Crazy Down Under radio show. Saturday mornings from 9 till 10 on 94.5 Kinglake Rangers Radio.
All right. Hey, let's move on to some listener mail. We've got a few that we can go over. First one came from our faithful listener, Justin. Justin's a truck driver, but he writes and says, for some time now, I've been trying to figure out life after trucking. He says, as this most definitely isn't something I intend to do for the rest of my life. Paid the bills and got him out of another dead-end job. But there are a lot of options, he says, he wants to explore, and a career in aviation is high on the list. Problem is, I don't even know what my options are, and I have no idea where to begin looking. He says, searching around using Google hasn't really yielded anything I'd consider useful, and more often than not, raises more questions than answers. He says, where can I go, or who can I speak with to get pointed in a direction to see what, if any, options might be open to me? He says, I've pretty much written off being a pilot for a living as a pipe dream. At 29, I think I missed the bus on that career path by about 10 years. Or did I? He says, realistically, I'm thinking more along the lines of ground crew or air traffic control. Given the nature of airports, it doesn't seem like the kind of place you just walk into and ask about job opportunities. Any suggestions? So we popped this out to our listeners, to you guys, on Google Plus and on Facebook. And, of course, it didn't have all the information from Justin's email, but we got a bunch of responses, a bunch of different ideas. Rob, looking at that list, are there any that particularly resonate with you?
Well,
not to put you on the spot.
No. First of all, I wanted to say that I sent Justin a note as well and said, listen, kid, 29's nothing. I didn't put on an airline uniform the first time till I was 39. So I wouldn't say you're dead and over with yet. But the main advice I would probably give somebody like this is if they really want to fly, don't simply focus on the airlines. There are all kinds of flying jobs out there. The airline flying type jobs are the ones that get all the swag. They're the ones that everybody thinks are the coolest and the only ones anybody wants. But there's a lot of really cool flying jobs out there that don't involve airline flying. So just keep that in mind.
Well, I don't have anything to add to Justin. I'd like to thank everybody who jumped on this bandwagon, Martin, Mr. Hartevelt, everybody who sent in answers. We got really amazing listeners.
Oh, we have the best listeners. You mentioned Martin Rotler. He said, if you haven't started building a network of aviation professionals, do it now. That is almost, if not as important, as skills. And we got an agreement from My Pilot Chronicles, who said, agree with Martin, it's who you know now these days. Make as many contacts as possible and go for it. Don't sit back and several years from now say, I wish I would have. Give it your best shot and see what happens. Jesus Calderon from Catalonia wrote in and said, first of all, get your commercial pilot license and then choose whatever suits better for you, from part-time instructor to any air job appealing to you. could be firefighting bomber, he says, advertising, scenic flights. You can do almost anything part-time without quitting your current job. Let's see. Paulo said, know someone in aviation. It's not so much that they get you a gig as there is so much as they show you the paths you could take. Jody Bromer also threw in NDT, non-destructive testing, is in huge demand right now, and a lot of local community colleges offer the certification. Kevin Garrison said, read his books. He threw in a plug for that. It's good to hear from Kevin. Let's see. And mine, you know, people may not be aware of it, but there's a podcast that Carl Valeri puts out that's called the Aviation Careers Podcast.
That's right. We had him on the show.
That's right. Carl is a great guy, and it's a great podcast. Very interesting. It's easy to find. It's www.aviationcareerspodcast.com. So there's something else to check out.
And just don't tell him you know us, and you might get the straight scoop.
Yeah. But I think what you said, Rob, is particularly good advice. You know, don't limit yourself. Aviation is pretty broad, and as some of the other listeners wrote in, there's lots of different kinds of aviation companies or companies that are involved in different aspects of aviation. So there's a lot of different opportunities there.
And even the colonel said, you know, there's always the reserves and Air National Guard.
Yeah, that was a great suggestion. So if any of you all have some other ideas, yeah, send them in. Or write us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com or add into the Facebook page, the discussion that's started there, or on our Google Plus community. Let's get some ideas flowing. Let's see. We heard from Ken Stringer. He sent in a link. A former pilot's animation recreates the San Francisco crash. And what is it? It's an animation. Actually, there's a couple of animations at the site. It depicts the Asiana Flight 214 crash at SFO. It's kind of interesting. And maybe what's even more interesting is this guy who flew 727s and some other aircraft. He made this animation to demonstrate what his company does, which is to generate these animations to use in recreating air crashes for investigations and litigation. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Thanks, Ken, for sending that along. Hadn't seen that.
Well, and I think what was really interesting about that was that it was essentially a version of the animation that showed the aircraft as it should have appeared on landing, and then sort of a ghost version right alongside that showed where the Asiana craft really was. And it makes the distinction between the two flight paths, it just jumps out at you.
Yeah, it's very good. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Take a look at that. It's worthwhile. Also, an email from Keith. He said, I just wanted to make a comment on last week's episode concerning the backward-facing seats on commercial planes. And you'll recall we mentioned that because some are saying that maybe that's something that should be done with commercial airliners as representing a safer cabin than front-facing seats. And he said he's a commercial aircraft engineer, and he's done a fair amount of work on floor structure and seats. He says, because the seat track is symmetric forward and aft, you could install seats backward without any mechanical difficulty. It would be exactly the same as facing forwards. He says, I think there was a question in the episode if this could be done, and so I thought I'd put my two cents in. He came in with a follow-up. He says, well, he's thought about it a little bit more. He just wanted to clarify what he said. He says, in most cases, you couldn't simply flip the seat backwards for outboard seats, because the seat struts aren't always centered in the seat row. He says you could probably switch sides. For example, if you wanted to flip a left-hand seat row, you would have to move it to the right side and orient it backwards. Center seats wouldn't matter because they are symmetric right to left. So that's interesting. That was something that we sort of raised and wondered about last episode. So I want to thank Keith for helping us out with that.
Did I say I love our listeners?
I know.
Here we're talking about reversing seats, and Rob was thoroughly confused.
Yeah.
But we had a listener out there that validated my theory that all you should be able to do is just turn the seats and face them backwards.
God, I love our listeners.
We do have great listeners. And, you know, I can even... So I hang out in a lot of forums where podcasters hang out. Some of them are just, you know, hobbyist podcasters. A lot of them are what I would call professional podcasters. And all the time you know, hear them bemoaning the fact that they can't get any feedback, they can't get any opinions from their listeners. They wonder if anybody's even listening. And it just makes me smile because we don't have that problem at all. We have vocal, passionate listeners who contribute. So thanks to all of you guys for really making this as much fun as it is. Well, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 258. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com/258. We want to thank our guest, Lieutenant Colonel Brian Allen. He's with the 146th Airlift Wing, California Air National Guard. We'll put the links in the show notes, but you can find them on Twitter at 146 Airlift Wing and on Facebook at 146th Airlift Wing. We'd like to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron and Steve Vischer. Find them at plaincrazydownunder.com. Also, Peter Johnson, who you can find at aviationextended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online. Mr. Robert Mark, let's start with you.
Sure, they can find Scott and I on jetwine.com. They can find Twitter at jetwine. Next week, of course, I think Sunday through Wednesday or Thursday or something like that of next week, it will be at Beautiful Air Venture. So let's make sure we tweet to each other and catch up there, folks. Yes, it'll be fun.
What's the hashtag, OSH13?
Right.
Hashtag OSH13.
Okay.
Right. And it's hashtag OSHBASH for Dan's event on Wednesday night.
Right, OSHBASH. Very good. And David Vanderhoof, where do people find you?
I'll be working Whitman Airport's home base Twitter account, following everybody. So make sure you Whitman Airport at Whitman Airport from Pennsylvania, or you can find me on our Facebook account or DM Vanderhoof, my own account on Twitter, or check us out on Google Plus.
Very good. And I'm Max Flight. Find me on Google Plus and Twitter is Max Flight. Also, you can visit me at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. And you can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com. They'll have links to all the sites we mentioned in the podcast. The shortcut, the easy way, airplanegeeks.com/258 for this episode. And as David mentioned, be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus. Also, if you'd like to stream us to your computer or mobile phone or whatever device, you can look for us on Stitcher.com and also in TuneIn.com. If you want to send us an email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, we have a listener line where you can leave us a voicemail. And Aunt Benet has that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS01.
Thank you, Benet. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Night, see you everybody next week.
So if you go longer than 5 minutes and it's really interesting, I'll just cut out some of Rob later to make space.
Okay, I'll try Max. I'll be as concise as possible.
So how much do you think they paid that guy to sit inside that F-86 all day?
It's an intern.
Oh, it's an intern? It's an intern. Oh, okay. Because there's a guy inside there, but I just wondered.
Okay. Yeah, it's an intern.
Grandpappy built it, Daddy ran it, and Junior put it into the dirt. Bag it, tag it, I'll edit it up for you.
Did I tell you guys that we're going to have an Aussie here at Camp Jetwine prior for a few days prior to AirVenture?
No, who's that?
Yeah, Bass Sheffers. Is coming over, and he's a big guy. Well,
they're all big guys.
Kind of like Steve. Well, Steve's a big guy too, and actually Grant's a pretty big guy. I wonder if there are any little Australians.
Well,
I guess that's what the possums are for, right?
Between Bass, Vischer, and I, that's three very large Dutchmen.
And David, I was not confused.
I didn't say it was the senility kicking in. I just said you were confused.
I was not.